Now, I'm curious, was the seizure of the county records an illegal act? Did the Newtown people take what measures they saw necessary to legally move the location of San Diego from Old Town, or did they have some authority to do so?
Well, there was legal authority to do so, but it was certainly disputed by those who wanted the center of the county, its records in the county courthouse, to remain in Old Town. And there was a protracted struggle that went on for quite a period of time, but ultimately it was a legal decision that enabled them to move the records and therefore the activity to Newtown. And, of course, this played a very important part in making Newtown the center of governmental and commercial activity.
Now, to what extent was moving the county records the decisive step that finally determined for sure that, as Elizabeth MacPhail wrote, Horton's town was no longer Newtown, South San Diego, or New San Diego, it was San Diego?
Well, I think certainly that was part of it. The official existence of San Diego as the county center, but certainly the other aspects of San Diego becoming such a large and important commercial center. Alonzo Horton had built a wharf at the foot of Fifth Avenue, and in those days, of course, there was virtually no overland traffic into San Diego. We have to really think of San Diego as almost being like an island until a railroad was completed in the 1880s. Prior to that time, very, very few people came in overland, very little in the way of traffic. The mountain passes were steep, and it was difficult to come in overland. You had to come through the desert if you were coming through the south. So the wharf really was the important thing about making San Diego into a thriving commercial center, because Horton built this long wharf. It was, I think, close to 1,200 feet long because the bay was shallow there, and it enabled big ships to come in and tie up, and they could bring in products and take out the agricultural products, which, of course, were San Diego's big export in those days, things like honey and wheat and wool, citrus products. So these things were what really made Newtown the important center of town. And then, of course, in 1872, there was a disastrous fire that destroyed most of the buildings along the south side of the plaza in Old Town, and that seemed to mark the final decline of Old Town as a really important center of commercial activity.
And so the focus of San Diego moved to Newtown, and the new location did quite well during the Tom Scott boom. But, Claire, as you mentioned earlier, that expectation of a railroad was not fulfilled. Boom became bust, and a once thriving town went into a downswing. Elizabeth MacPhail points out that Alonzo Horton, even in bad times, stood by his ailing city.
When the Depression of 1873 hit, instead of throwing in the sponge and going back up to San Francisco, he stayed with it and spent his own money keeping it going. And for much of the time, why, he was the sole employer in San Diego. Everybody else here was just living on climate, and we're retired people. But as far as occupation and building is concerned, why, for several years there, why, he was the major employer. People left in droves, so he really had to support the city, his town, in order to keep it going. And so between the 73 and 83, when the next railroad boom came along, why, he was pretty much running things, but much with his own money.
Now, this is the period following the Tom Scott boom, and I'm curious what it was that resulted in the bust, and what happened in that period that we're talking about of the 1870s.
Well, the bust for San Diego came about because of the failure in the stock market in 1873, and so Tom Scott and the Texas and Pacific Railroad Corporation were ruined as a result of the collapse of the stock market. This, of course, was not just something that was of local significance. It was of nationwide significance. The what was referred to as the Panic of 1873. Banks failed. Businesses collapsed. Tens of thousands of people were thrown out of work. There were labor riots, and you know, it was really a bad scene all over the United States. It wasn't just San Diego, but the railroad, of course, the hope of the railroad was the major event in San Diego's history from its inception in 1850, and they never gave up hope. Another very important group of people came to San Diego at about the same time that Alonzo Horton did, and these were the Kimball brothers. And they bought up the old National Ranch, and this became National City. Interestingly enough, to make a comparison, where Horton was able to buy, you know, his land, all of what's now downtown San Diego, for only $265 because he bought it from the city trustees. The Kimball brothers paid $30,000 for the land that they bought from private owners who had in turn bought it from the original Mexican grantees of that rancho. But Frank Kimball, in particular, was very desirous to have a railroad built to San Diego, and he went back to the East Coast and discussed whether there was any possibility of reviving the Texas and Pacific. When he saw that there was not, then he went on to Boston, and he talked to people who were in charge of the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railroad. And after many complicated negotiations, what ultimately happened is that the trustees of the city of San Diego agreed to turn over the lands that had been designated for the Texas and Pacific, roughly 4,000 acres in San Diego, and the Kimballs agreed to turn over 10,000 acres in National City, and everybody in both San Diego and National City rushed around, also raised money, and gave it all to the Santa Fe, which then promised to build into San Diego. There was a local railroad corporation here to actually handle the building of the railroad. It was called the California Southern. But in fact, it was a like a subsidiary of the Santa Fe Railroad.
When was that railroad completed?
Well, it was finally completed with great flurry into San Diego in 1885, and the bands played, and you know, the everybody was thrilled to death, and that inaugurated the great land boom in San Diego. Southern California, not just San Diego, of course, but all of Southern California was absolutely transformed by the great boom of the 1880s. Now, this was due to the fact that both the Southern Pacific and the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe built railroads from the Midwest out to the Pacific coast, Los Angeles and San Diego, and completed these lines in the mid-1880s. And, of course, the railroads had millions of acres of land to dispose of, and they advertised heavily all over the United States and in Europe as well to bring people to buy their land. In addition to the railroad land, which was offered for sale, of course, there were millions of acres of government land as well, which were free to homesteaders. Anyone could get, at that time, a 160-acre piece of land, homestead this land in rural areas, simply by agreeing to make some kind of improvements on it and living on it for 5 years. So the population of Southern California just ballooned in a very, very few years. The boom, as I say, was really set off by the advertising campaigns of the Western railroads because they had so many so many acres of land to dispose of, and of course this made their property, not only the land which they retained, but their rail services and depots and other facilities, these were all made much more valuable by having greater population. The grand opening of the Coronado Hotel took place in February of 1888, and most people feel that that marked the peak of the boom. After that, everything went downhill. The bottom fell out of the inflated land market. Banks began to tighten up on their credit, and very, very significantly also, the railroad reneged on some of its promises, moved its main terminal to Los Angeles, and its repair shops from National City moved away to San Bernardino. And by 1889, the bust was well underway. Prices declined, the speculators left town, and for sale signs were all over the landscape.
It is through contemporary literature that we receive some intimate glimpses of San Diego during this explosive boom period. Dr. John Adams is Professor Emeritus of Literature at San Diego State University, and his extensive studies of the literature of San Diego have included this period. And he says one of the best accounts is by Theodore S. Van Dyke. It's called Millionaires of a Day, An Inside History of the Great Southern California Boom.
It records the day-by-day feeling of a social binge, we might call it, from the perspective of a closely observant and intelligent San Diegan, as Van Dyke was. According to him, the speculators were frankly enough, gamblers and speculators, and took their paper profits seriously, but when the paper profits disappeared, they took their losses with a better grace than might be expected. And so his account in Millionaires of a Day is both lively and psychologically penetrating. Gives a kind of a sporting spirit which tempered the greed of these real estate developers. They were itinerants, they were slickers, but they were also human beings, perhaps influenced by the temperate and pleasant climate of San Diego. They had to get out, but they certainly had enjoyed themselves while they were here.
Dr. John R. Adams, Professor Emeritus at San Diego State University. The great boom of the 80s was not to last forever. What happened?
The boom of the 80s collapsed in 1888 and 1889. The completion of the Hotel del Coronado, as people have looked back on it, seems to have marked the peak of the boom, and from then on things went downhill. Part of the reason, of course, was that the prices had simply gone way out of sight, and the banks began to call in their loans and to tighten up on giving credit, and people realized that these kinds of prices were utterly unrealistic. But a very significant factor in bringing about the bust in San Diego had to do with the what I call the Great Railroad Ripoff. The Santa Fe Railroad had originally promised, in exchange for getting all of this land, roughly a total of 17,000 acres, and I don't know how much in actual cash from the city of San Diego and the city of National City, they had promised that they would locate their railroad shops in National City, which of course would provide a great deal of employment and center of activity there, and they were going to locate their main terminal in the city of San Diego. And they did these things initially, and the tracks of the Santa Fe Railroad were laid from Colton on an angle that ran through Temecula Canyon and then over to the coast, coming to the coast at about Oceanside, and then on down the coast to San Diego and on down to National City. The Southern Pacific had its tracks that ran from Los Angeles all the way down the coast to San Diego. Well, in the period of the 1888 and 1889, not only did the Santa Fe remove its shops from National City and locate them at San Bernardino, and they decided that they would have their main terminal at Los Angeles. They got, you know, more money, got a better offer from Los Angeles, and so they decided that would be their main terminal. So the area lost those two things, but most important of all, it lost its direct connection because the tracks that ran through Temecula Canyon were washed out in one of the rains of that time, and they were never rebuilt. And so from that point on, San Diego did not have a direct rail connection. You had to go through Los Angeles first before you could get into or out of San Diego by rail. And this was a great disaster for San Diego, and for many years, of course, people hoped that there would be a direct connection. And when we get into talking about John D. Spreckles a little later on in the next program, we'll see how he was able to bring that about finally in 1919.
Well, then, in a sense, the railroads benefited from a mere temporary fulfillment of their promise.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And, of course, they still retained the ownership of all of the land that had been given to them. The San Diego Land and Town Company, which was the real estate subsidiary of the Santa Fe, continued to sell land for many, many years, and the development of Logan Heights in San Diego, which was part of their railroad land, took place in the 1890s when it was one of the most desirable subdivisions to live in. And, of course, National City and Chula Vista were the developments, essentially, of the Santa Fe Railroad through its subsidiary, the San Diego Land and Town Company.
Did the bust of the late 1880s relate in any way to anything that was going on economically on the national front?
Yes, it was just as the earlier panic of 1873 was a national event, so the depression or the panic of the late 1880s was also related to national events in the United States. There was another nationwide panic in 1893, and this simply tied into that. Banks failed again all over the country. People were thrown out of work. Businesses collapsed.
The collapse of the boom in the late 1880s brought Alonzo Horton down with it. And again, we speak with author Elizabeth MacPhail.
Horton, of course, he was wealthy after his early 70s. And he used his money during the 70s and early 80s. And then he began to make money again. That's when he built his beautiful home up on at First and Fir, and was well off again. And but with the bust of 1888, that really took him down, so that by the 90s, he was a poor man, and he was not influential as far as the city was concerned. People referred to him as Father Horton. He was respected. He was they were rather amused at him, because he would watch from his home when the ships came in, and then he'd be down at the wharf to greet the people and tell them about San Diego, and the ship captains would tell the people on board to watch out for this man, this old man with a long white beard, and so they were prepared to have, he was official greeter, I guess you would call, and then he was would try to get people, of course, to buy not only his land, but any land that was for sale. But actually, as far as the effect of the collapse of the F-88, it took him with it, and he was never able to recoup. And in fact, he was dependent later on the city money that was paid for the Horton Plaza.
I was going to ask you about that. Would you tell us about Horton Plaza and how this provided him in later life with a small source of income?
Yes, that's rather interesting. He had, after he had built the Horton House, which was opened in 1870, he just dedicated the half block across the street as a plaza. But it was never officially given to the city. It just was taken off the tax rolls and was just used as a plaza. So in the early 90s, the city began thinking that they might like that block for something else and looked into the title and found out that it was not clear, that there was some question of ownership. And so the city wanted to buy the land from Horton, and he finally agreed to sell his interest, which was questionable as to whether he, it was just a question of his, what title he might have. So he agreed to sell it for $10,000, and the city agreed to pay it to him at the rate of $100 a month without interest, with a proviso that should he die, the payments would stop. And so those payments started in 1895. And ended in 1903 when he was 90 years old, but the city thought they were would that he would never live to get that $10,000, but he got the full $10,000.
Horton Plaza has a toehold on my heart. I grow sad, get mad, go bad when we're apart. Hobos guzzling their Red Mountain, pigeons nuzzling by the fountain, buses hustling beyond counting in my lovely little park. A-L-O-N-Z-O-F-H-O-R-T-O-N, Alonzo F. Horton, you're my friend.
Well, Alonzo E. Horton might not have liked the spelling of his middle initial, but Hunt and Peck's song does strike a familiar note in its description of Horton Plaza. Horton Plaza is perhaps the most well-known San Diego landmark that bears Horton's name. And today, we may not think of it as being that fine a tribute. Interestingly, Horton himself was not totally pleased with the plaza in 1890, when he wrote to the Board of Public Works that, instead of being an attractive and useful place, it is unsightly, a receptacle for dust and filth, and a hiding place for vice. He suggested that each tree should be enclosed by a circular seat of iron, so small that a toper could not recline on it, and having a high back formed to protect the tree. Very truly yours, A.E. Horton. Former San Diego Mayor Frank Curran, who's involved in efforts to redevelop the downtown area, including Horton Plaza, and who gave us a copy of that letter, says maybe times haven't changed all that much.
Well, apparently Alonzo Horton was very concerned and almost changed his mind in relation to giving the... Let me correct that. He never gave Horton Plaza to the city. He sold it to the city. But his letter suggests that he gave it to the city. But after he had seen what was occurring in Horton Plaza after the city had taken it over way back in 1890, he decided that he would chastise the local council for not cleaning it up and getting rid of the bums and the birds, I guess. It sounds like the same problem we got today.
Horton first successfully focused interest on what is now downtown San Diego, but throughout the nation, the period of prosperity following World War II and the automobile and the new American dream attracted Americans away from their cities into the suburbs. It's been a more recent trend, though, to return attention to the center city, and San Diego is a part of that trend. Claire, in particular, how did our own downtown redevelopment interest develop?
Well, from what I have heard, although there was a generalized kind of recognition in the early 1960s that attention should be redirected toward downtown, and so an organization called San Diegans Incorporated was formed, and ultimately, they were responsible for promoting the development of the new city administration building and civic concourse and whatnot. But the initial concept of just getting Horton Plaza itself cleaned up is what led directly to all of the redevelopment plans. Delza Martin one time said that there was a very simple suggestion that the city council allocate some funds just to cleaning up Horton Plaza. And after the council got hold of that and the planning department got hold of that, that they decided, well, instead of just cleaning up the plaza, what we need is to redevelop a larger area. And this led then to the plans for the Horton Plaza redevelopment area, the entire 15-block area that hopefully will have the exciting shopping center and recreational facilities and so on that are being planned. And finally, it looks as if Horton Plaza is also going to be cleaned up, too.
Frank Curran is involved in the downtown redevelopment projects as the executive vice president of the Central City Association.
Well, at the moment, there are four or five major projects planned, and one is not a redevelopment project as such, and it has the most appeal, I think, to the average person, and that's the Gaslamp Quarter, which is strictly a citizens' participation project. It does not envision at this point any vast expenditures of public money except for possibly some demonstration projects in a given area of sidewalk furniture and improvements to give the theme to the area that is to be developed. The balance of that project, at least at the moment, is conceived to be developed strictly on personal financing by the property owners themselves through private financing arrangements. But the rest of the downtown area that has been designated for redevelopment, one project is practically complete, and that's the City College, and it was a urban renewal project. And for all practical purposes, it is complete at the moment. There's still some work yet to be done, but the redevelopment project itself has been complete. It's the only urban renewal project in the United States that was completed on time and stayed within the budget limits that were set. And we're kind of proud of that, or at least I am. The other ones, the Horton redevelopment project, which is the so-called retail center in the downtown, is the one that is in about halfway committed at this point. The other major project area in downtown is the marina housing project development, which lies west and south of the Horton Plaza development project, roughly south of Broadway and east of Harbor Drive, which is designed to be basically housing. The other major project that has been designated for the downtown area has been the so-called Columbia area, which is basically the Santa Fe Depot and the area around it, including a proposed site for a new convention center.
Frank Curran says the process of redeveloping the downtown area is a gradual one, and don't expect striking changes in a short period of time. But he says already a downtown visitor can see signs of progress. Ironically, some of the difficulties that San Diego faces with this project go back to Father Horton and his layout of New San Diego.
When downtown was laid out, as the old story goes, Father Horton tried to get as many corners as he could so the blocks were relatively short. They're 200 by 300, and it doesn't give us any opportunity to service these facilities from internally. We do not have any alleys. We don't have any service lanes of any kind in downtown, and that's the way it was laid out. If we could take an eraser and go back and wipe out the street lines, we probably could do a lot better design. I think Father Horton was a stinker in a way that he not only started downtown, but he also started on the wrong foot in terms of the actual design of the layout, the plat layout of the city itself. But we can live with it. We can come up with some answers that will suffice.
L-O-N-Z-O-M-H-O-R-T-O-N, Alonzo F. Horton, you're my friend, I kid you not. Alonzo F. Horton, thanks a lot.
When John Nolan, the city planner, came to San Diego in 1908 to make proposals for the comprehensive planning of the city, he remarked about the effects of this gridiron plan that Alonzo Horton had used in laying out the city. Of course, Horton was not the first to do so. This was widely used all over the country, and as a matter of fact, in San Diego itself, the gridiron plan had been used by Andrew Gray and William Heath Davis when they laid out Newtown, and Horton attached his streets and his subdivision layout to that. So, in a sense, they're really responsible. But what Nolan said in 1908, commenting on this, is that despite San Diego's advantages. He said, it's neither interesting nor beautiful. Its city plan is not thoughtful, but on the contrary, ignorant and wasteful. It has no wide and impressive business streets, practically no open spaces in the heart of the city, and no worthy sculpture.
We can look back and see some of the problems that have been created by Horton's original layout of the city of San Diego. But of course, he was a visionary, and it was Alonzo Horton who did see the potential for the site of our present downtown, and who made that site a success. But the story of Alonzo Horton himself in San Diego has a bittersweet ending. Horton lived to old age in good health. He had lost his fortune and his influence in San Diego. But, Elizabeth MacPhail notes, he also lived to see early signs of his city's future growth.
Well, it is a sad story, there's no question about it. And the fact that he did spend his money for the benefit of the city. He gave away hundreds of thousands of dollars just in land to encourage people to come to San Diego. He gave land free to every church that wanted land. And so he had given away hundreds of thousands of worth of value in land. And he had done so much to try to keep the city going when he had the influence. But in his later years, when he got into his late 80s and up to around 90, why, his influence was gone because his money was gone. But people still looked at him as the father of San Diego, of Newtown. Apparently, he was quite a jolly, jolly old man. And when he would meet people at the boat with his long white beard, why, some of the children would say, oh, there's Santa Claus. Mm-hmm. And he would go down in his horse and buggy, and as he would go around town, he would drive every day around looking over his town, even as an old man. And he would see how the changes had been made, and they all pleased him. Even when the Horton House was torn down by U.S. Grant, and that was torn down in 1905, he was there to take out the first brick, and he was happy to see it go because he knew something even grander would go in its place. So he never regretted seeing any of his buildings go, because he knew that something even better would go up. But apparently he was a very friendly person. They said, I think one anecdote was that he was poor, as I had said, but he would go downtown, and there was an ice cream parlor down on Fifth Street, and he'd go in there and sit on a stool and ask for a sarsaparilla. And then there was another place that had sandwiches and food that you could get for a nickel. And he'd go in there and buy his food. And, of course, very often, why, people would give him, like, his sarsaparilla and ice cream if he wanted it, just because he was the father of San Diego, and people knew that he didn't have much money. Fortunately, he was in good health up to the last few weeks of his life. And on his 95th birthday in 1908, he was interviewed by the newspaper, and he was quoted as saying, referring to his city of San Diego, "It is the most beautiful place in the world to me, and I had rather have the affection and friendly greetings of the people of San Diego than all the rulers of the world." He was very satisfied with his city and knew that it would be much greater, much bigger. He expected larger buildings, greater buildings, and he expected that the harbor would be full of ships in the future. In other words, he had the vision of what would come, and if he were to return today, he would not be surprised.
Elizabeth MacPhail, author of the book The Story of New San Diego and its founder, Alonzo E. Horton. In one sense, our story of Horton ends with his death at the age of 95 in 1909. But in a real sense, our story doesn't really end at all, because Horton's effect continues on into today. Claire, in conclusion, there were other people who tried to move San Diego to what is now the downtown area. Why was it that Horton was the one who succeeded?
Well, I think it's because he was the right man at the right time in the right place. Certainly, there were some external circumstances that made it more difficult for Gray and Davis to attempt to do this in 1850 as they had done. And Horton benefited certainly from the fact that the development of the railroads was such an important factor of post-Civil War United States. Certainly he benefited also from the fact that so many people were moving west, that there was a tremendous interest in the West, and lots of people wanted to come out and take up land anyway and invest. But I think that his own enthusiasm, his sense of the future, and as Elizabeth MacPhail has said, his persistence, his dedication, his real love of the area, and his ability to sell it to people when he went to San Francisco, when he was here in San Diego, talking to people, getting them to invest, to put up buildings, and so on. These characteristics of Horton were important in the development of the city also.
What would you say his real importance is to San Diego?
His long-term significance, it seems to me, is that he was truly the father of modern San Diego. When he came here in 1867, San Diego was just a little village of about 2,000 people. And Horton had this dream of building a city on the shores of San Diego's Great Harbor. He invested all of his funds and all of his energy in this project. When he first came, as we've shown, he bought, 960 acres, virtually all of what is now the heart of downtown San Diego, for just $265. And he was laughed at by the local residents for talking about building a city in the sagebrush. But he persisted. He had the land surveyed, he began building structures, and, of course, most importantly, he built a long wharf at the foot of Fifth Avenue to enable commercial vessels to dock and unload here. He was active in the efforts to bring a railroad to San Diego, an event that was finally completed in 1885. The population boom that followed laid the foundations for the urbanization of San Diego. All of its important municipal services were begun in the 1880s as a result of that vastly increased population base. Water, sewer, electricity, public transit, fire and police protection, reorganized municipal government, and the beginnings of some of our cultural institutions, all of these date from the 80s as a result of the railroad boom. With this kind of persistence and dedication and optimism, this vision of the future, and the willingness to invest his own funds, his own time in the city's development, these characterized Horton. He did not give up and leave the city and go back to San Francisco during the Depression of the 1870s, after the failure of the first railroad boom. Instead, he stayed on, and he built more houses and office buildings, and he continued to provide employment to people. And he paid most of the expenses of city government out of his own pocket during that time. He gave away over 20 blocks of land to city and county government institutions and to all different religious denominations. Of course, he benefited himself, but he was pretty well wiped out by the bust that followed the boom of the 1880s and was very glad to receive that meager $100 a month that the city council paid him for Horton Plaza. And when he died in 1909, he left no estate. He had nothing to leave to his widow except the property on which their home was built. Ironically, that land was not even in his own subdivision. He died without owning any of his original purchase. Horton's significance for San Diego, it seems to me, is very great. His developments laid the foundations for our modern urban growth. Unfortunately, he didn't have very much imagination in laying out the street plan, and as a result of his relatively narrow streets and small blocks, we have traffic congestion and difficulty in assembling land for redevelopment purposes today. But on the other hand, he did have the imagination to see that the city should be built on the shores of the harbor. He successfully relocated the center of San Diego's development from Old Town to its present location on the waterfront. And this move ensured the steady growth of San Diego, because the development of the harbor has been the most significant factor in San Diego's economy. Our transportation facilities of sea, air, and railroad are all focused on the waterfront location. And all of our major industries are directly related in one way or another to the harbor. fishing and canning, shipbuilding, aircraft manufacturing, naval installations, tourism and recreation. All of these are, of course, related to the harbor. In one of Horton's last interviews, not long before his death in 1909, he said, "I'm not surprised at what has happened here in San Diego. I have seen it all, the tall buildings and the great ships at anchor. I dreamed it all."
Dr. Claire Crane, San Diego historian and chief consultant for this series of programs on San Diego history. Horton's life ended just as San Diego was beginning to take shape as a great bustling city. Its rapid development was to a great extent the result of huge investments made by John D. Spreckles, many times a millionaire, a man who had a financial interest in almost every area of San Diego's urban development. The life of John D. Spreckles is the subject of next week's program. 12 Who Shaped San Diego is a series of radio programs on local history, biographies of 12 great men and women who have left their mark on today's San Diego. The programs are heard each week at 12:30 Tuesday afternoon, with a repeat broadcast Wednesday night at 8 o'clock. A resource packet is available with these programs. Send $2 to KPBS-FM, San Diego, 92182, and ask for the San Diego History Resource Packet. We also welcome your comments on this series. The address again is KPBS-FM, San Diego, 92182. I'm Peter Hamlin, series producer, thanking you for joining us. 12 Who Shaped San Diego is a production of public radio station KPBS-FM and is made possible by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities.